Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're cutting straight through the noise for an investor-focused look at one of the most dynamic economic zones on the planet, Southeast Asia.
Or ASEAN, as you'll often hear it called. And we're really zooming in on the engine behind a lot of that growth, digital financial services, or DFS.
Right. And the backdrop for this, our source material, is the Big Economy SEA research program that's Google, Temasek, and Bain. They're charting the whole digital economy there towards, what, $300 billion in GMV for 2025?
That's the trajectory. $300 billion gross merchandise value. It's just a massive signal that this region's digital economy is really maturing.
Absolutely. So our mission today isn't just, you know, reading out numbers. We want to examine exactly where investor capital is flowing within DFS, what business models are actually working.
And what are the big shifts happening that create opportunities or maybe risks for investors looking at CN?
Exactly. Let's dive in. Okay, segment one. Let's lay the foundation. When we talk DFS in Southeast Asia, we have to start with the sheer scale. It's not niche anymore, right?
Not at all. The core number to grasp, I think, is the gross transaction value for digital payments across the ASEAN 10 countries. The forecast, $1.4 trillion in 2025.
Wow. Okay, $1.4 trillion. Let's just sit with that for a second. That's an incredible amount of money moving digitally.
It really is. And it points to a fundamental shift in how people live and pay. You remember, not long ago, cash was king everywhere.
Oh, absolutely. Pockets full of different currencies trying to break large notes.
Well, that's flipped completely. Back in 2019, the data showed over 60% of transactions were cash. Now, it's the reverse. Over 60% are digital.
In less than 5 years. That's incredibly fast adoption.
It's a real consumer migration. Driven by convenience, sure, but also accessibility. Digital wallets, payment apps, they're just there.
And that kind of shift, it needs solid infrastructure underneath it all. Are we still seeing fragmented payment systems holding things back, or is that getting sorted?
It's getting sorted, and quickly. I mean, every single one of the 10 ASEAN countries now has its own national unified QR code system. That's huge for domestic payments.
Okay, so within each country, things are smoother. What about across borders?
That's the next big step they're tackling. 8 markets now have cross-border QR interoperability. It directly feeds into this bigger vision of regional payment connectivity.
Right, making it feel more like a single economic zone, at least for payments.
Yeah.
Easier for businesses to scale.
Definitely. It reduces friction significantly.
So connecting this back to investors, if the infrastructure is there and the scale is massive, where is the private money going in the broader digital economy? Is DFS grabbing a big slice?
Oh, absolutely. The biggest slice. DFS is hands down the primary target for investor capital in Southeast Asia's digital space right now.
How much are we talking?
Well, look at the last 12 months. DFS pulled in somewhere between 45 and 50% of the total deal value across the entire digital economy.
45 to 50%. Just for DFS?
Yep. And that's actually up quite a bit. The period before, it was closer to 30%. So investors are clearly doubling down on financial technology as sort of the backbone for future growth.
Okay, that's a strong signal. Let's move into the funding dynamics themselves. So, segment two. We heard the overall private funding number tick up a bit last year, $7.7 billion. We need context for that, right? It's not exactly party time like 2021.
Not even close. Yeah, $7.7 billion is up 15% year on year, which, you know, is positive. But you absolutely have to remember that number is still 70% below the record high we saw in 2021.
70% below peak. Okay. So capital is flowing, but it sounds like it's flowing very carefully.
Extremely carefully, with a lot more discipline. And that discipline shows up really clearly in where the money is going.
Right. You mentioned this shift. Investors are almost entirely focused on later stage companies now.
That's the defining trend. The appetite for early stage risk, well, it's significantly lower. Investments are heavily, heavily concentrated in Series C, D, E plus rounds.
I'll concentrate.
We're talking about 80%. Roughly 80% of the total funding value went into those later stages.
Wow. 80%. So bigger checks into companies that are already more established?
Exactly. They're chasing proven models, companies with scale. And the flip side, naturally, is that early stage deals, seed, Series A, Series B, those have really contracted.
Doesn't that starve the pipeline, though? If all the money is chasing the winners, where does the next generation of innovation get its fuel? Is it just caution, or is it bordering on fear?
That's a fair question. I think investors would frame it as a necessary correction, a flight to quality, maybe? The market is demanding a clear path to profitability now. Speculation is out.
Okay, so profitability is the new mantra. Are companies delivering on that? Is there evidence that portfolios are getting healthier?
There are positive signs, definitely. We're seeing data where 80% of early stage investors say the majority of their current portfolio companies are either profitable now or have a very clear, believable timeline to get there within the next year or so.
80% showing profitability or a clear path. That must help confidence.
It's crucial. That focus on fiscal health, on sustainable business models, that's what rebuilds confidence for the long term.
And confidence also needs exits. Big valuations are great, but investors eventually need to see a return through an IPO or an acquisition. How's the exit landscape looking?
It's starting to look more promising. There's actually quite a robust pipeline building up. Over 150 potential IPO candidates identified across just Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore.
150 companies getting ready for IPO.
Getting ready, yes. Now, obviously, they need to actually list successfully. But the fact that so many are even at that stage meeting the governance standards, having the scale it shows the ecosystem is maturing, that's critical to attract future investment.
Got it. So the money is disciplined, late-stage focused, demanding profits, but seeing potential exit paths emerge. Let's dig into which specific DFS areas are getting that capital. All right, segment three. Where is that disciplined late-stage money actually landing within DFS? Digital lending seems to still be the kingpin, revenue-wise.
Absolutely. Lending is the powerhouse. It's forecast to bring in $22 billion in revenue in 2025.
$22 billion. Out of how much total DFS revenue?
Out of a total forecast of about $34.9 billion. So lending is, you know, the vast majority of the revenue pie right now.
Okay. But lending, especially consumer lending in emerging markets, carries significant risk. How are these digital players managing that risk effectively? What's their edge?
Their edge is data, specifically ecosystem data. They often partner with super apps or embed themselves in e-commerce platforms. This gives them access to really granular transaction data for underwriting.
So they see spending habits, income flows much more directly than a traditional bank might.
Exactly. It gives them deeper, almost real-time insight into a consumer's financial stability and behavior. That's their secret sauce for managing risk. Digital banks are also seeing strong loan book growth by leveraging these ecosystem partnerships.
That data advantage sounds like it would heavily favor the big established platforms with those deep integrations. Is that what we're seeing?
We are. There's significant market concentration. The top 5%, just 5% of lending apps capture half, 50% of all users.
Well, top 5% get half the users. What about the smaller players, the microlenders?
It's a tough environment for them. Regulation is tightening across the region, and scaling efficiently requires serious data infrastructure, which many smaller players lack.
So what happens to them?
Well, the data shows a pretty alarming closure rate. About 50% of these smaller, often more aggressive microlenders shut down within a two-year period.
50% closure rate. Ouch. So the investment takeaway there seems pretty clear. Mm-hmm. Stick with the established players who have the data and scale.
That seems to be the prudent approach, yes. Avoid the temptation of potentially high margin but very high risk microlending and focus on those platforms using transaction data for more sustainable growth.
Okay, stark warning there. Let's shift gears slightly. What about digital wealth platforms? Are they moving beyond just basic savings accounts and attracting serious investment assets?
They definitely are. They're hitting real scale milestones now. We're seeing multiple digital wealth platforms crossing the $1 billion mark in assets under management AUM.
Over a billion in AUM. What's driving that growth? What's the appeal?
It's really a combination of factors that appeal to the new generation of investors. Lower fees compared to traditional wealth managers, for one.
Always attractive.
Right. Then there's the seamless digital onboarding, no lengthy paperwork. And they often start with simple, accessible products like micro-investment options, maybe mutual funds, which lowers the barrier to entry.
So they hook users with simplicity and low cost.
Yeah.
How do they then grow those relationships and assets? Are they getting more sophisticated?
They have to, and they are. They're quickly evolving beyond just the basics. We're seeing platforms offer things like fractional shares of international stocks, curated thematic portfolios, catering to users whose own financial literacy and appetite are growing.
Makes sense. Capture them early, grow with them.
I see.
Let's talk about the elephant in the room for DFS trusts. If the tech is slick and the products are improving, why is there still this hesitation?
Yes. Trust. This remains the fundamental challenge for the entire sector. Despite the convenience and the tech, many consumers just don't trust these digital native players as much as they trust their traditional bank, especially for larger sums or more complex needs.
Is it just trust or loyalty too?
Loyalty is definitely weak. It's very common for consumers to use multiple e-wallets, for example, they shop around. And crucially, surveys show many people say their primary e-wallet provider is not their first choice if they need credit or want to manage their investments.
Interesting. So they'll use the e-wallet for daily payments, but for borrowing or saving seriously, they might still default to the bank.
Often, yes. The digital players have nailed speed and user experience, but that deep-seated trust, the kind traditional banks build over decades, that's still a work in progress for the digital challengers. It's a key risk factor underlying that $22 billion lending market.
A critical friction point, which actually leads us perfectly into our next segment, the potential game changer, AI. Okay, segment four, we've got scale, we've got sophisticated products, but also this trust and loyalty gap. Can artificial intelligence AI be the wild card that helps bridge that gap or redefine the landscape?
It certainly has the potential. And investors seem to think so, too. AI is arguably the hottest investment theme across Southeast Asia right now. It's pulling capital away from other areas.
How much capital are we talking about?
Over the last 12 months, more than 30% of all private funding in the digital economy flowed into AI-related startups.
30% just for AI. That's huge. How many startups are we talking about?
The ecosystem is growing fast. Around 700 active AI-related startups identified in the region.
Okay, 700 startups attracting nearly a third of the capital. What's the vision? How could AI specifically change financial services?
Uh-huh.
I saw this term, agentic transactions.
Right, agentic transactions. That's sort of the next frontier. The idea is that your AI agent, linked to your verified digital identity and preferences, handles financial tasks for you almost invisibly.
So instead of me opening an app to pay someone,
your AI agent could initiate the payment, verify it, maybe even handle currency conversion for a cross-border transfer using those QR rails we talked about, and reconcile it all potentially without you needing to interact directly with an interface.
That sounds incredibly seamless. Frictionless, really.
Exactly. It removes the friction points, which could theoretically help build user reliance and maybe even trust over time if done securely.
But there's always a but. Implementing sophisticated AI isn't cheap. How does the return on investment stack up in Southeast Asia, where labor costs are generally much lower than, say, the US or Europe?
That is the core tension. It's the unique ROI challenge for AI adoption in ASEAN. These advanced AI models, often developed globally, come with high price tags.
And the labor they might replace is relatively inexpensive.
Precisely. The weighted average wage across Southeast Asia is only about 5% of the average U.S. wage. So if you deploy an expensive AI to automate a task currently done by a person, the cost savings might not be compelling enough to justify the AI investment. The math is just different.
So if automating jobs doesn't provide a slam dunk ROI yet, why the huge investment spike? Where are businesses finding value from AI right now?
The immediate value is coming from efficiency gains and internal cost savings, rather than direct labor replacement or massive revenue jumps.
Okay, explain that.
The investor surveys bear this out. 64% of investors reported seeing cost savings from AI implementations in their portfolio companies, but only 29% reported seeing significant revenue growth directly attributable to AI so far.
So it's more about using AI for things like better risk management, smarter data analysis, optimizing internal processes.
Exactly. Improving efficiency, reducing errors, making better decisions internally. That's where the tangible returns are being felt first. The customer-facing, revenue-generating AI applications might take longer to show strong ROI region-wide.
Got it. And geographically, where is all this AI investment concentrated? Is it spread out or is there a clear hub?
Oh, there's a very clear hub. Singapore. It's unequivocally the center of gravity for AI investment in the region.
How dominant is it?
Hugely dominant. Singapore captured $1.31 billion in private AI funding recently. That's about 55% more than half of the entire AI investment across all 10 Asian countries.
55% into Singapore alone. Wow. Okay, it really is the regional AI capital.
No question about it.
This has been fascinating. Let's try and wrap this up with some key takeaways. So pulling it all together, the digital financial services story in ASEAN is one of incredible scale. That $1.4 trillion GTV forecast is staggering, and it's attracting almost half of all private investment.
Right. But that investment is now highly disciplined, focused on late-stage proven models with a clear path to profitability. We're seeing real sophistication emerge in lending and digital wealth.
That persistent trust deficit compared to traditional banks is still a major factor, especially for higher value services. Loyalty is shaky.
Exactly. The tech is there, the scale is there, but consumer confidence for big financial decisions hasn't fully migrated yet.
And then you overlay AI. Huge investment, potential to create truly frictionless agentic experiences, but facing that unique ROI challenge due to regional wage levels.
Making the immediate focus internal efficiencies and cost savings, driven largely out of Singapore as the investment hub.
So, looking ahead, maybe the final thought for our listeners. What really dictates the next phase of growth? It feels like there are these big unknowns.
I think you're right. It really boils down to two major wildcards for the next decade. First, how quickly can AI move beyond just cost savings and genuinely start driving new revenue streams and maybe solving that trust issue through sheer seamlessness?
Okay, the speed and impact of AI adoption. What's the second wildcard?
Regulation. You have 10 different countries, 10 different sets of rules, all evolving. Will they manage to create effective, maybe even harmonized regulatory frameworks that enable this next wave of AI-driven cross-border finance?
Or will fragmented national policies inadvertently slow things down, creating friction, just as the technology is ready to eliminate it?
Precisely. That tension between the pace of technological possibility, particularly with AI, and the pace and coherence of regional governance, that's the space investors really need to watch. Will the frameworks unlock the potential or inhibit it? That's the multi-billion-dollar question.